Well, good morning. The title of my talk is A Scalable Spectral Element Eulerian Atmospheric Model. And I added that extra E, Eulerian, to distinguish it from Steve Thomas's C model, so I guess mine is CM. But also because I want to distinguish it also from the semi-Lagrangian model that I'm currently developing. And I'll talk about that on Thursday. And this work is done in conjunction with Tom Roseman at the Naval Research Lab in Monterey. The motivation for this talk is based on computing resources or changes in computing resources from large vector machines to distributed memory computers. For example, we got rid of all our vector machines at the Naval Research Lab, and we're looking at, well, we had to port everything to MPI, and we're looking at the future where we have lots of a multitude of less powerful CPUs. And the current existing model, which is called NOGAP, that's the Navy's Operational Global Atmospheric Prediction System, uses global approximation functions, these spherical harmonics or spectral transform methods. And basically, it scales like on the order T, where T is your triangular truncation, and it costs roughly T cubed. The new model that I'm developing is a spectral element model, uses local approximation functions, which Steve talked about, these Legendre, where the Lagrange polynomial is based on the Legendre Gauss-Lobato points. And so they are very local, and they scale like order T squared and cost about order N T squared, where N, let's see if my mouse works here. Yeah, where N is your polynomial order. Here's a comparison of the current model on the left, that's NOGAS, and the new model that I'm developing, the spectral element model on the right. And basically, the differences are NOGAP uses spherical coordinates, and I'm using Cartesian coordinates now. And that's basically to avoid polar singularities because it's essentially a grid point model. The current model uses spectral transforms in a horizontal, which are global basis functions. And I'm using spectral elements, which are local high-order basis functions. The vertical coordinate in NOGAP is a flux form finite difference. And I'm actually right now for this talk, I'll be showing you just results on the finite difference vertical coordinate, but I'm switching to spectral elements in the vertical as well. I have some results, but I won't show those today. This NOGAP uses Gaussian latitude-longitude grids. That's the only grid it can use. The new model will be able to use any grid, including adaptive unstructured grids. Just doesn't matter what kind of grid it is. As long as you read in quadrilaterals, it can do the problem. And let's see, I guess I talked about the number of processors. Well, the maximum number of processors that, say, our current operational model, which is the T159, can use is roughly about 240 processors. You can tell I haven't figured out how to use this mouse yet. In comparison, the spectral element model could use something like 24,000 processors if we had that many. On the left, we have the lat-long grid used by NOGAPS. And the way the domain decomposition is done on distributed memory computers for NOGAPS is basically each one of these latitude rings, right, has to be on processor. So in this case here, you have about 120 of these latitude rings for T159. So that's about roughly the number of processors you will use. The way spectral transform methods work is you have Fourier polynomials or series in each of these in the horizontal direction, and then in the north-south lat-long direction, you have Legendre polynomials. Well, in contrast, in the spectral element method, you basically have a tensor product of Legendre polynomials in this direction and then in this direction. And the thin blue lines you see here are the actual spectral elements, and the red lines you see there are actually the collocation, the high-order collocation points, which are Legendre Gauss-Lobato points. And the thick blue line I've shown here could represent a processor. So for example, you could have each spectral element on its very own processor. The atmospheric equations look something like this. So you have mass, you have momentum, and remember, I'm on Cartesian coordinates, so that's why the Coriolis term looks a little funny here. And then I have this idea from Jean Côté, where you have this Lagrange multiplier that constrains your particles to remain on the surface of the sphere. And the energy equation I'm using is the potential temperature, and this is what the hydrostatic equation looks like. I guess I should say that for the purposes of this talk, I will only be talking about leapfrog method in time, which is a second-order explicit method. And the reason being is that I'm using that to give a better comparison between NOGATS and my model. NOGATS uses a semi-implicit method, but it built that semi-implicit correction on the leapfrog method. The vertical discretization for this talk, I'll be using sigma coordinates, second-order flux-form finite differences, the same as in NOGATS. And like I said, I'm currently testing an unstaggered higher-order spectral element method. I don't want to talk too much about spectral elements, but basically, you know, say you have this capital phi are your prognostic variables, and then you can write it as this operator L phi equals zero. And so the spectral element method, like any Galerkin method, is, you know, the weak problem is find phi and psi, which are your basis functions, that are contained in this space, a Hilbert space of square integral functions, such that the inner product between the operator and the basis functions, the residual, equals zero. Okay, and this is done in an element by element sense. That's why I have this omega sub E, where E are your elements. And so you basically have the union of all these little elements give you your entire domain, which is your spherical shell. Steve showed some of these basis functions, so I won't talk too much about the tensor product basis functions, but I will say this. In my case, because I am using Cartesian coordinates, I have to define my basis functions in terms of xyz space, right? But then trying to do that and then solving a problem xyz space with basis functions in actual physical space is very difficult. So what I do is I map to this computational space where I have xi and eta are your horizontal space. In other words, they lie on the surface of the sphere, and then I have the zeta coordinate system that comes out radial, that's a radial component. And once you do that, you can break it up into some kind of tensor product form like this. I'm going kind of quick here, but I'm going to show you some properties now, the spectral element or Eulerian atmospheric model. And the first thing I want to show is that the spectral element method does indeed give you exponential convergence for smooth problems, right? So for example, remember right now, just for the purposes of this talk, the spectral element is only being used for the horizontal operators. So I want to show that it gives you good results. So let's go back to the shallow water tests, Williamson et al. Cases 1, 2, and 3. And here I have on the vertical axis the L2 error norm, and on the right and on the horizontal axis I have the order of the polynomials, of the Legendre polynomials. Right. So I start off from 4 all the way to 128. And you can actually see the exponential convergence for cases 2 and 3. Case 1, I'm not so sure. It starts giving you some kind of exponential convergence, then it starts to flatten out, and I'm not sure why that is. But cases 2 and 3, you can see you start at about, at polynomial order of 64, you get errors below 10 to the minus 10th. So you're quite good. And the bottom line, I don't know if you can see this number at the bottom here, but that's 10 to the minus 14th here, which we're not getting. We're not getting that that good a result. We're getting about 10 to the minus 13th, I guess, for case 2 and 3 by 128. So it does give you higher order for the horizontal operators. The next thing is I wanted to show some results with the spectral element compared to NOGATS. And these are more or less qualitative results. I haven't shown any error norm comparisons between NOGATS and the spectral element model. So what I've done is I've run this Rossby-Horowitz wave that I got from Terry Williams at the Naval Postgraduate School. I found it in some report from the 70s. So here we have NOGATS at T159, really, is what it should be, using 24 levels, which is our, by the way, this is our operational resolution that the Navy runs, and about five-day forecast, which is, again, what we're using. And I show the pressure, temperature is right, top right, U and V velocity at the bottom panels. And I just want to show that, for the most part, the numbers look the same between this model and this model. And there's a little shift, not very much. It looks more or less the same. So let's do that again. This And again, I'm using roughly a resolution in the spectral element that's about, you know, T159 with 24 vertical levels. And this is all in the paper that I just submitted to Monthly Weather Review, and I have another test case as well that I show there. Of course, after this week, I have new test cases to run, so I'm looking forward to that. You know, I don't know if the Navy's going to like when I run no gas on those test cases. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to blow up, probably. So I showed that the spectral and discrete horizontal operators achieve exponential convergence for smooth problems. I've shown that the spectral element is as accurate as no gaps, at least for that test case I showed you. And now I'd like to show you how this spectral element model scales on distributed memory computers. Okay, this is a kind of an ugly plot, but what I'm trying to show is the spectral element methods communication stencil. So let's say these big, well, let's look at this black box, the thick black box that's surrounded by those two red dash boxes. And let's say that's a processor, so that's PROC, right? And then, so we have, this PROC has a neighbor to the right, neighbor number four. It has another neighbor to the top, on top, which is neighbor number six, and so forth. So it has eight neighbors, okay, that surrounds that processor. And the P's here represent the elements that are on processor. So I'm not talking about what order these elements are. Let's just keep it really general. So what happens is that for this processor to do everything on processor requires the information at the perimeter to be contained on processor. Okay? So for example, this processor then will have to send its perimeter values to its eight neighbors. And then once the eight neighbors have those perimeter values, they can do everything on processor. And that's a function of the C0 continuity of spectral elements that you have to enforce at the boundaries. And here I have a result of the T160 with 24 vertical levels, and I show the line, the solid line is the spectral element model, and the dashed line is no gaps. Running on vertical axis is simulation days per wall clock hours. This is on an IBM SP3. And on the horizontal axis, I have the number of processors. So you see that I have a linear scalability all the way up to 600 processors for my model. And at this resolution of T159, we could only use 120 processors for no gaps. And this, by the way, is using an explicit leapfrog method, both using the same time step. Admittedly, no gaps can use a much larger time step. And right now I'm stuck to this time step.
How is that your operational model if they can only get an absolute simulated
day? Well, they use a bigger time step in reality. Yeah, because they have a semi-implicit. This is just an explicit comparison for an explicit scheme. They don't do a 2D decomposition. They do 1D, yeah. Yeah, it's more efficient for them to do it that way. So here I just kind of focus in on on that same result just to show you that, well, the one thing I want to show you, that know that there's actually a small break in the linear scalability. It actually starts, there's a turn like right around here. So it's not a constant slope like I get in the spectral element model. Now, I don't know if I can use more processors or if I could continue this trend with more processors, because it took basically an act of God to let me use 600 processors on the IBM SP3. I waited about a couple of weeks, and then DC had to okay the run. I don't want to do that again. So here now I have a performance of the spectral element model running 24 vertical levels, and I guess I should explain what this plot is. Again, on the vertical axis I have simulation days per wall clock hours, and then on the horizontal axis I have the number of processors. And you probably can't see this all that clearly, but these alphas, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 4, and alpha 8, that represents the ratio of the number of elements by the number of processors. So in other words, the alpha 1, which is your dotted line up here, means that every single element is done on its very own processor. So you can see that gives you the best performance. That gives you about 10 simulation days per wall clock hour. And as you increase that ratio, in other words, as more and more elements are packed into one processor, that performance drops. Okay. So what that's telling you is that if you have many processors, you should be able to use the spectral element quite efficiently. Okay, so the next test is to do climate type runs, which is, climate, by the way, is a bad word at the Naval Research Lab because they only like numerical weather predictions. If you ever say you're going to use a climate run, they kind of cringe a little bit. But anyway, this is one of the test cases that has been run by everyone, so it's something that I need to do. And so here's after 1,200 days with a T64 with 20 vertical levels. This is the what's my mouth here? The zonally averaged zonal velocity and a temperature, and this is sampled every 3 days. So it looks all right. And I guess the other selling point about the spectral element method is that spectral element methods really are domain decomposition methods, right? They're a combination of finite elements with spectral transform methods. And so for that reason, besides giving you linear scalability on distributed memory computers, it also means that it gives you a geometric flexibility to use any grid you want. You're not stuck to a lat-long grid or whatever. You can use anything you want. And one of the interesting features is that we have mesoscale models that run using the boundary conditions generated by our global models. And so one idea would be to have, say you want to run a really high resolution study of flow in the US or whatever, then you can probably, you would have a mismatch of a high order mesoscale model and then a very coarse global model. So the idea isn't to have a fine resolution in your global model that then gives you better boundary conditions for your mesoscale model. And so an example of that would be, here's case 5, the shallow water case 5. This is just your typical cube grid which with about 6,000 grid points. And this is about this is the result after 10 days. So this is your geopotential, U, and V velocity. And here you have a grid that's a telescoping grid that's centered on the mountain, right? It has less points than your regular grid. And it gives you more or less, it gives you the same results, and you actually get, you don't get these little wiggles you see here over in this guy here. My mouse died, there it is. And again, here you can see it in the U field, things are very smooth up here versus over here. And of course, as you go away from the high resolution part of the grid, you're going to start getting the same kind of junk that you get down here. But anyway, that's just a qualitative result of why these adaptive or unstructured grid methods are desirable to explore. And here's a flow. This is the baroclinic test case. I just ran the mountain, but it's right on the equator, and I just used my adaptive triangular grid method, and then I divided each triangle into three quadrilaterals, and then I constructed the high-order basis functions. These are about eighth-order basis functions inside. So that's why you see the red, you see these are the basis functions, and the blue are just all the elements. So it just looks really ugly, but all the elements are in here, basically. And so that's just an example of what the types of grid you could use. And it doesn't really matter whether the grid looks ugly or not. It'll give you good results. Finally, future plans. I want to further test the spectral element in the vertical. And it's not so much going to be something that's going to help out the Eulerian model, but the semi-Lagrangian model that I'm developing will be able to use this high-order stencil in the vertical as well to give me my high-order interpolation functions. And I'll talk more about that on Thursday. And the other thing I'm doing is this is the year where I want to start putting in moist physics and real terrain. So I need to go and put all the physical parameterization, which is going to be, I'm sure, a big ordeal, but I have a whole year to do it. Thank you.